Welcome to Refugee Radio.
Are you okay with it?
Yeah. It's a normal. Actually, it is not normal, but as a part of my life, it's like normal. I should handle it. I have got no choice. I've got nobody around myself to do something for me. Every day is difficult. It's the same as before. My government took my life. Here, this government took my life. And when you look at the past or future, you haven't got any hope and future. Everything's collapsed, exactly like tsunami or earthquake.
Syed is an asylum seeker from Iran. He was tortured and jailed in his home country. His family still live there. This documentary will explore the effects of being a refugee on one's identity and personal relationships through the experiences of Syed and of those working with refugees in the United Kingdom.
I had enough money, I had enough chance and time to bring my family with myself. But I didn't do that. I didn't came here as a refugee or asylum seeker. I came for business, but I found out I have got a problem with my government. I was on the torture and jail 2 weeks before that. For that reason, my family have a problem with government as well. My government tortured my wife to force me go back to Iran, and I should release them, but at the moment I cannot do anything.
For many asylum seekers and refugees in the United Kingdom, quality of life is poor.
I haven't got any situation or future here. My life is rubbish. All of the human being has got a limit, and sometimes I am fed up and I don't want to continue life. You are not allowed to do anything. You have got a big gap with public. Another gap is come from your own country people, because them stay in the same situation or they pass this situation, and both of you are scared to come to each other and have a company, because in the third world country you think maybe they come from the government as a spy. For that reason you're getting lonely more than yesterday. Every day more than last day. Every month more than last month. Until when you die or have a permission to stay or do suicide.
Unlike what we hear about and what you read about in newspapers, they live in horrible, horrible accommodation. They get very little money, very little support. And recently, these organizations who were providing excellent support, they have closed down. So it is unfortunately getting worse.
Fanique Adam from Freedom from Torture, formerly the Medical Foundation for the Care of Victims of Torture.
Refugees and asylum seekers who are in the process are offered housing, and essentially a single person receives £35 per week. If you consider that the basic benefit for a single person is £60 per week, it's quite a lot less. Buying food alone on £5 per day is really a challenge, not to mention, you know, having means of communicating with other people. And also going back to, you know, just recognizing refugees and asylum seekers as human, having a pint means that you won't eat that day. And of course, you know, having a pint isn't necessarily a vital need, but in many ways it is. It's the sort of social aspect around it that's important, more important than the pint itself. My name is Izinda Franklin Hautzager, and I'm the coordinator for the Refugee Health Network at MEDACT. MEDACT is an advocacy organization, and they deal with issues of health, well-being, access to health care for when health is compromised by war, poverty, exclusion, and environmental damage. So it covers quite a broad area.
Many asylum seekers who seek refugee status and those who work in the refugee sector complain of a system that is characterized by long periods of waiting, uncertainty, anxiety, and fear. Sheila Reynolds from Mind.
It subjects the average human being to phenomenal amounts of stress. Going through the asylum process is a profoundly stressful experience. The level of uncertainty, the lack of control, these are both really, really hard things for anyone to have to deal with. And then if you throw into that things like destitution and detention, and then you add to that also the history these people have come from, have experienced torture, have been separated from their families, you know, if it's an unaccompanied asylum-seeking child, alone, no guardians, no support, no family or community infrastructure. It's a lot of pressure, a lot of stress to put on someone. And I think what is potentially most cruel about it is that in some cases it takes such a long time to get status and to get the whole situation resolved. In other cases, it's incredibly fast. I mean, in the detained fast track process, before you know it, you're in detention and then you're refused and then you're out of the country. The asylum process pays very little regard to the psychological state that people are in when they arrive in this country, their capacity to remember what's happened to them, their capacity to process information. A lot of people feel that there is a culture of disbelief within the border agency.
I work as a counsellor, seeing clients for ongoing counselling, assessment, new referrals. The clients we see, they are all survivors from torture from all around the world. UK Borders Agency, they want everything with evidence and proved evidence to be submitted for them to be able to say, okay, you are entitled to stay in this country because your life in danger. But people who run away from their country fear being killed to be able to come and straight away open up and talk about their experiences the way the UKBA expect from them. There is high tension, and I cannot see how this tension will somehow disappear. And it's getting worse and worse. In most cases, it's very, very difficult to bring any evidence. Some, they have physical evidence, which could be documented by us or by other doctors. And some, they don't have this physical evidence. It is psychological. So it's much more difficult to document that.
I know that people who go through the process are subjected to repeated interviews and questioning, and they're often challenged about their accounts. Not only does that ignore the impact of stress and displacement and trauma on your capacity to recount what's happened to you, but it in and of itself inflicts trauma on people. And this is one of the things that we see in feedback that we get from clinicians, practitioners, who really struggle to provide mental health treatment to people who are going through the asylum process, because they can do nothing more than at best stabilise someone or attempt to manage someone. They know they're not going to get recovery from someone who is going through the asylum process because the trauma continues. They're still in the situation of trauma.
Quite often in our experience we hear refugees who really, really struggle with what they have to go through in terms of their adjustment and in terms of how the whole process of gaining their asylum status has been for them. My name is Anthony Sigalos and I'm a senior psychotherapist here at NAFSIAT, the Intercultural Therapy Centre. It is constantly a very, very, very difficult experience for them. And as we all know, it takes a long time. When you have a lot of issues in terms of psychological adjustments, in terms of practical adjustments, their experiences have been very, very difficult. And the therapeutic environment allows them to at least feel contained during those periods of time. When your mind is preoccupied, as we can understand, with the uncertainty of the future, it's very difficult to intervene on a psychological context when the practical reality is very intense and very pressuring. That's how we intervene sometimes, only on that containing level that the person needs for them to be able to cope with that kind of level of anxiety that the uncertainty of their asylum application brings to their life. Sometimes they feel that it is important for them to have control of something, and quite often that is their therapy. We definitely take this on board and we address it therapeutically. That is another element of the cultural sensitivity, if you like, that we have incorporated in our work, which is manifested in the way that we consider seriously all those issues in somebody's experience.
We think we don't have this kind of problem in the future. For that reason, nobody can imagine if you stayed in the same situation, what you do.
Syed was an international businessman before he claimed asylum in the UK.
I meet a lot of refugee or asylum seekers before I stay here. As a friend, go to a restaurant, in public, everybody. If you go in another country for holiday, you will see a lot of different nationality. And I didn't think one day will come and I will find the same situation.
You've probably seen in the media bogus asylum seeker. Even asylum seeker has reached a point where it really depersonalizes. I think increasingly we're seeing these people as numbers. Language, I think, is very, very important. There is very much a process of dehumanization, and there's a separation. How many of us know an asylum seeker? How many of us know a refugee? Many of us might say none. But how many of us know a person from Iran that had problems there? How many of us know? You know, it's very different.
Many refugees and asylum seekers are victims of torture. The effects are profound.
Torture is torture, psychological or physical or both, and both usually. The effect will stay. I mean, I saw a client today for the first time for counseling. He's been living in this country for 26 years. And this is the first time he referred himself to us because he said, and this is what he said, all these years I have wanted to survive and I have wanted to move and build a life for myself. But I realized I couldn't because I cannot get these things out of my mind. Now that's what he said. I don't know what are the things in his mind, but he is ready now to talk about his experiences after 26 years being in this country.
Torture has got two different things. One of them is body torture. When you have a body torture, you think It's better you die, you want to die, you want to finish that kind of torture, and you try to handle it. It has got a period of time. End of the time, you will be free. You come out from the jail. You haven't got pain in your body, but you have got a pain in your brain. When you think about the past, you are scared. And why? And how it was the... I don't know. I cannot explain to you what's the feel. It's a very strange feel. If your body damage from the torture, until the rest of your life, you have got a pain every day, second by second. Especially when you use a strong painkiller and it doesn't work. You cannot do anything. You are not allowed to anything. You have an extra pressure as a pain. Now, here, I'm not in the body torture, but I am under mental torture. Because when I think about myself, my body damage, I have got a lot of pain in my body and use a high dose painkiller every day. I should use a sleep tablet. Without that, I cannot sleep. And when I use that, just I sleep 2-3 hours per day, not more. And I saw bad dream every night, every second. I'm on the torture. They torture my wife, my children, my family. And I wake up and find out I'm here. It was dream, but bad dream. And now I'm under mental torture, worse than body torture. Because I cannot do anything. And they think, okay, I come here, I'm safe. And when I did a suicide, after come out from the hospital, care team came to my house and look at me every day, ask me, do you want to kill yourself again, again, again? If I want to stop thinking about that, they remind me, do it. And I haven't got any answer for my family. I cannot explain to my children what is this problem, why we have a problem. Their mother cannot explain to them as well. My wife cannot understand if I had a problem with my government, why they catch my wife. And my wife getting upset from me, why I cannot do anything for them to be free and release them. For that reason, I'm under torture more than when I went in the jail and on the body torture. I don't blame anyone, because they are human like me. Doesn't matter they did bad things or good things to me. It's matter they are human, and all of us we do mistake. And all of us come to this world, and when time come, we die. You cannot blame the people or like or don't like, trust or untrust the people. You cannot judge them. When I look in the past, how I made my life and how I was useful for my family, now everything's collapsed.
We talk about how much they suffer and how difficult their life are, but we did not talk about how resilient they are. They are a survivor. They have survived enormous torture, and they have been through horrendous situations in war zone, in prison, different experiences, but they all survived and they all have enormous resilience. The problem is they don't see that, and then you have to work with them to help them to regain trust in themselves, and also to work with them to help them to refine the part that they thought that they have lost. And they have lost it because they can't find it. And part of counseling is to actually help them to find that part and familiarize themselves again with that part who really disappeared in their mind, because they see themselves as a new person, they see themselves as a different person. With the right help and the right support, they will find that. Problem is, if we give them all this support and outside there is not much support, then we find a lot of problems with that, because the welfare system outside and the system, the asylum system, is really difficult and it's getting more difficult.
Refugees surprise us with their resilience. Refugees may appear to be extremely distressed, may appear to be extremely depressed, unwilling to engage in any effort to adjust, overwhelmed by their experiences that they left behind. They're overwhelmed by their separations, by their losses, first and foremost. And when we put the lost in the context of bereavement in the West, all these different contexts of losses are devastating. And they're expected to go into a process of having energy to concentrate on a number of issues on a daily basis, which they find very, very difficult to engage, and which impact at the same time very negatively on their process of adjustment, or what is perceived as a good process of adjustment, and sometimes that goes in complete contrast to what, for instance, the services expect for these people to be able to. So it works against them, and this is an issue that for a lot of them, for instance, when people are expected to speak the language, to learn the language, any effort that should be there, it's not there because of their inability to engage, because they're overwhelmed. This is a real issue, an absolutely difficult experience for them. And it takes a lot of time, and unfortunately, time is not on those people's sides, because during a process where you need to be proactive, perhaps where you need to know what to do, where to go, find the right solicitor, find the right information, the right advice, that takes energy and that takes a lot and lot of time. And for them, their experience might simply be that they want to stay in bed and not move at all because of the way they feel. So it is a very difficult reality indeed for them.
Dealing with these mental health issues needs an awareness on the part of the clinician, but it can also be difficult for the person to access services due to stigma and stigma in their communities about what that illness is. If you become increasingly unable to connect, if you have an illness that you can't properly vocalize or share with family members, you can see how this would drive a serious wedge between families.
I didn't want to continue life, but I don't know who find me. When I wake up again, I find out I'm in the hospital, and everybody were kind to me. They wanted try to help me, do something for me, but it was just first week or first month. I didn't want continue life. I angry about myself, not them. Why then I die? Why God didn't let me die? Why I should continue life like this? I'm not animal. Just wake up every day, eating some food, and night time go to bed. And tomorrow, again and again and again. For that reason, I am upset. Why my life should be continued. My wife, my children, they cannot understand why I am here. Sometimes they lose the control as well, like me. I was useful man, now I'm not useful for myself. How can I useful for my family and after that for human being? My wife had a suicide as well, because of torture, because of the pressure, because of the jail. My children on the mental torture as well, because they didn't see me, and some part of time they didn't see the mother, and they haven't got happy time like go cinema, park, have fun.
Sheila Reynolds from Mind.
I'm working on a one-year project that's looking at raising awareness amongst commissioners at primary care trusts in the southeast of England about the mental health needs of migrants within their local population, and looking at ways in which they can improve the commissioning process to make it more sensitive to those needs and consequently result in mental health services that are accessible and responsive to the needs of migrants. Within refugee and asylum seeking communities alone, we see very high levels of anxiety and depression. Large numbers of them have experienced torture before they came to the UK, high numbers of PTSD. They're more likely to experience poor ill health than the resident UK population. There's quite a lot of data out there about what their mental health needs are. To what extent are those needs being met within mainstream mental health services? What we're hearing repeatedly through our local Mind associations and through migrant support organisations is that to a certain extent those services are not appropriate, and by appropriate we might be saying that they're not responding to the language needs of migrants, or they might not be sensitive to some of the, I suppose, wider cultural needs of migrants, say their faith or the role of the family within recovery. But then alongside that, there's issues about access, and access is really the crux of the problem when it comes to migrant mental health. There are a lot of barriers in the way to accessing mental health services. The key one is really language. As you can probably imagine, accessing any kind of service requires being able to communicate. And if you have recently arrived or you haven't been able to access any sort of ESOL courses, and as we all know, they're being cut, then the chances of you're being able to communicate effectively are considerably limited. And then when you're talking about mental health, obviously there's a big push now to move towards talking therapies, so trying to get people off medication and into psychological therapies. You know, that relies on people being able to talk about, you know, what they're experiencing, what their problems are, and that's very hard if you're having to do that in a language that's not your mother tongue, a language that you're not comfortable with, a language where the vocabulary is not familiar to you. You know, to a certain extent, some services are meeting that need through the use of interpreters, but that's fairly patchy. We're seeing a lot of interpreters that don't function well within a mental health environment. They might have experience even of working with refugees and asylum seekers, but they don't necessarily understand sort of the mental health context and some of the vocabulary that's being used. And then in a lot of cases, there simply isn't any interpreting service, either because it's not funded and the service provider thinks it's too expensive, or, as is often the case with GPs, the service is there, but they're not aware of it and they're not using it, or they're not using it appropriately. And as a consequence, you see a lot of really poor practice in terms of using family members, children, to act as interpreters for their parents. And that throws up a lot of ethical issues. And when you're talking about mental health, it's extremely inappropriate to be using, you know, a child or a family member to be interpreting issues that might draw in problems within the family, or things that perhaps someone doesn't want to reveal in front of family members. There's a whole raft of other factors that create difficulties. I mean, there's level of awareness of mental health itself within migrant communities. They might not come forward in the first place. And then, you know, that combined with perception of statutory services. Understandably, refugee and asylum seeking communities are very anxious about drawing attention to themselves, either because they think it's going to have a bad impact on their asylum claim, or because they don't want to be identified. If they're here irregularly, they certainly don't want to draw attention to themselves for fear that they might be removed. So you sort of got those barriers coming from within migrant communities. There's a low level of understanding of how the NHS works, of how mental health services work. So for example, you see quite a bit of misuse of health services, and this is generally not just mental health. You see, for example, high numbers of people turning up at A&E looking for help with problems that they really probably should have taken to their GP, but they don't because they don't necessarily know that that's how it's supposed to work. Or they might not have taken it to their GP because they don't have one. I mean, registration with GPs is another big issue. You try and persuade the GPs to register people, it appears to be discrimination.
Anthony Segalas.
The founder of NAFSIAT, Jaffa Karim, together with a number of professionals from the mental health services and social services, set up NAFSIAT in order to help the ethnic minorities who perhaps felt that they weren't able to approach mainstream mental health services, mainly because of the language barrier and because of a number of other issues. And there was a lot of stigma attached to mental health, continues to be so, and there was also an overrepresentation on black and ethnic minorities groups in mental health institutions. The need was identified back then to concentrate on these kind of groups where they felt that perhaps they weren't being understood within those services. People do come here because the therapy centre is able to address those issues and take them on board. And particularly when we talk about issues of culture, issues of race, for those people who have struggled and they have felt that their experiences were such that they wouldn't want to walk into a therapeutic environment with those issues not being respectfully addressed. Over the years, we have always offered therapy in different languages because we also felt much more comfortable with the idea of working on a one-to-one as opposed to a trio situation where we have an interpreter in the room. So we'd always work with a therapist who speaks the language of the client or the patient. We have a number of languages like Arabic, Amharic, Bengali, Farsi, Ga, Greek, Japanese, Korean, Krobo, Tigrinya, Turkish, a list of languages. And over the years, we may have other therapists who speak other languages, but we always tend to have our therapists on a bilingual basis so that they can provide them. I'm leading the Breakthrough Project for newly arrived refugee families who have survived conflicts. A lot of the people who arrive in this country go through a process where they lose any other connection with their family members. And approaching it here from an individualized perspective where we offer psychotherapy one-to-one, we found that it's not very helpful when we do not consider and that we don't include the context of the family, regardless of whether the family is present here in the UK or not. So we approach it with that frame in mind, and we've been offering this service for some time now, and we hope that we will continue to offer it, providing that we secure the funding.
Cultures influence everybody, especially the asylum seekers and refugees. When they come here, they found themselves in a very different society, in a different culture, and the expectations are totally different.
Finique Adam.
In a way that makes them hold on to their culture much more, because they become much more familiar with the way you supposed to express something. And that where the services like as the counseling comes into it, because in some cultures where talking about feelings and emotions are not very desirable for a man, in this culture it's encouraged, or in counseling it's encouraged. So the conflict they go through is huge. And it is very, very interesting when you go through this conflict in a session and how providing a safe place helps them in a way to break away from that culture. But culture influences them a lot. The historical background, the family they brought up, they're all factors that influence how they present themselves and how they present their feelings and how they talk about their experiences.
You are not allowed to do anything. You are not allowed to work.
The system is overwhelmed. The system hasn't been helpful, creating a great deal of frustration in terms of all these people trying to find work, which in itself is going to give them a sense of identity. It is very, very important for them to feel that they can adjust, and part of their adjustment would definitely be through finding a professional identity.
For Syed, his sense of self and identity has been eroded.
When you are younger, you are full of the energy. You don't lose the hope quickly. When you stay in the body torture in the first time or second time, you are younger, you can handle it, and you can fight again, because you think you have got a time. I had a problem with my government, but I knew behind the door my family is waiting for me. In the jail, I can see a lot of people with my language and same situation. They understand me. But here, how can I explain my situation to people? They don't give you just permission to stay here. They give you identity as well. When I talk about identity, it doesn't just come with one passport or driving license or something like that. It's come from how I have got a power to change my life again and to be useful for myself and after that my family and for public. When you haven't got power, you blame yourself. When I came here, I was younger. As a physical body, I had more power and I could control myself day by day more than now. But I getting older, it's very hard for me to find my way. I shouldn't talk to you as a useless man. When you have got an identity, then public law system, government let you swimming in the pool. When you cannot swim in the pool, you will lose a lot of things.
Azinda Franklin Hautsager.
A lot gets lost when one has to flee a country, and sometimes their ability to communicate with people from their home countries is also severely compromised. You're away from home, you know, it may be that you can't afford telephone service to speak to someone. There's no confirmation that there's telephone service on the other line. And so the process of fleeing can have a major impact on friendships and families.
When I came here, my daughter had a 10 years old, my son had a 11 years old. But now they growing up, I didn't see them day by day how they growing and getting bigger, older. I didn't see them laugh, I didn't see them crying, I didn't touch them. I lost a lot of things. When you cannot touch what you like, what give you feel as a life, it's horrible. Sometimes I can contact with them with email or mobile, but not always. They continue life as a hiding, and we don't want the security police to find them. We have a talk and change number or something like that, or another friends or family go there and give them the mobile telephone to contact, not with our name. Sometimes 2 weeks, sometimes 1 month, sometimes 1 week. It depends how is them situation. At the moment, nobody can touch me here. When you haven't got power or you are not able to do some things, you are not allowed to have anything, you don't go to the public. You don't see anybody, not just your family. And you had not contact to people, slowly, slowly going far away from them. Slowly, slowly show them I'm not useful. Slowly, slowly dating, you cannot help them. And you haven't got good feel. You are under pressure, mental torture. You don't know what's happened in the future. You haven't got any hope, any wish. For that reason, you don't going out to have contact with people. When you haven't got contact, you cannot have a friendship or relationship with anyone. Simple as that.
Whilst being aware of the fact that we do not want to overgeneralize the experiences, finding a therapist who speaks their own language reconnects them with something that is lost in the social context. It brings that aspect of their need to address that loss in their lives, which for some of them is important at an early stage. A lot of people, perhaps psychotherapeutically, may argue that that may create a context where you hold on to a reality that perhaps needs to change so that you achieve a greater level of adjustment. But on the other hand, somebody who really struggles and it's on an early stage, that level of communication is needed in order for them to move on. The person has to deal with the reality, the new reality of this country, and cope with a reality that is very much, for some of them, even unknown. The unknown is from both sides. The unknown here in this country, what's going to happen with the asylum application, and also related to the life that they left behind. Cultural adjustments are different for every member. When they arrive together in the same environment, let alone when they're spread all over the place. And we have a father in one continent, the children in another, and the mother in another. So, of course, all these different adjustments are going to impact on the overall interactive context of the family and the communication within the family. These adjustments are closely connected to the different ways of adjusting psychologically to a new experience, and conflicts do arise. Identity is lost somewhere along the line when those changes appear to be extremely, extremely strong and the adjustments are very, very difficult. So identities change, identities are lost.
Those families who were lucky enough to come here and be together, as well as dealing with aftermath of their experiences on them as a family and as an individual, they have to deal with their life here and the practical problems that they face here with the system. It is so complicated. That will add an extra pressure on the family. And sometimes we forget about how big an impact has on the family, because they have to survive on a daily basis and they have to think about building a new life for themselves and for their family. If they face obstacles, practical obstacles, and they feel that they are unable to understand and deal with the system, then they put much more burden on the family and much more pressure, and a lot of families, they suffer as a result of that. And for those who left their families behind, that's a totally different ballgame, if you like. It's just the feel of guilt and the feel of shame of leaving their family and letting their family down is huge. They feel that they should not have come and they should have bear the torture and imprisonment, even killing and being killed in prison so that they could be near their family. In a way, it becomes like an obstacle for them to actually reflect on themselves and their experiences, because that will dominate in a way. They feel that they let their families down.
Trust has always been the issue. And when you go into a different environment, you just want to test the water, which applies to everyone, to all of us. And we can appreciate how it would be for them when some of them, they don't even speak the language. So imagine that, if we are to go to a different country and not speak a word of the language, trust wouldn't be there. You know, it would be a very big issue for us. So there's no doubt about it, and that's why centers like Nafsiyat, intercultural centers, centers that provide that kind of space to those people, I think primarily is very important for them to start addressing and approaching that issue of trust, at least within that safe, if you like, context of therapeutic intervention. It has been a struggle, first and foremost, because we are constrained by time, and approaching somebody's experience within a very short period of time of 6 weeks or 6 months, it's very, very little.
One of the effects of the torture is actually losing trust in themselves, losing trust in themselves for not being able to hold on, not being able to fight back, not being able to bear and stay in their own country and stay with their friends or families, and running away from torture and from death. So they lose trust in themselves, and then the torture makes them lose trust in others as well.
It's very difficult to try and engage somebody in a therapeutic context where the issue of trust has been damaged tremendously. For those people who have witnessed atrocities and have gone through horrendous experiences, that even to think about them, let alone talk about them, would be unbearable. So it takes a very long time, but we cannot possibly assume that it cannot happen, it cannot be done, and we cannot assume that the strength and the resilience of a human being is not there. One would assume automatically that if you do not have the refugee status, the asylum status sorted out, then that would definitely create a lot more anxiety about the future, which is in a way true. But surprisingly enough, our experience has been that the people who do get the asylum application sorted out, the difference in terms of their cultural adjustments to the host culture is not dramatically different within the time that we might have assumed.
A lot of asylum seekers with mental health problems fixate on status. They may even fixate to the extent that they're not conscious of other factors impacting on their mental well-being. They may not be able to address some of the historic issues that have caused their distress or depression. They just want status. And ironically, what often happens is that they achieve status, and actually that's when their mental health really deteriorates, because status is not the cure that they thought it was going to be. And suddenly the horrors of adapting to life in the UK, of dealing with poverty, of social exclusion, of poor housing, of unemployment, all of these things suddenly pile onto them. And, you know, they can't ignore it anymore, because the thing around the legal process, the asylum status, is gone. And that's often sort of when we see the worst crises.
Once, if you like, the basic need is sorted out, then this is the space where everything else comes to the fore, and we really need to deal with it. So we don't have if you like, if I'm allowed the expression, a bunch of happy bunnies who are over the moon because the asylum application is sorted out and they're going to be the happiest people on earth. Now, that's as we can appreciate. It doesn't apply to them, and in actual fact, it doesn't apply to anyone, because we all have difficulties every day to face. So some of them, genuinely, the experience of going back to their countries of origin can only be dramatic and perhaps with no future at all. That again creates an awful lot of anxiety, and almost to the point where it imposes a trauma, if there has been one in the first place. That fear is tremendous, and the despair is overwhelming, and they want to find help wherever that help may come from. Sometimes we may have a session the following week and we don't have it because the person has already been deported. So it's also difficult for the therapist as well to go through that process of having to not have a proper ending with your client. So it can be very challenging. Imagine how this experience might be like for that person, knowing that they have to leave what they appeared to think it would be a safe place for them, and perhaps for some of them it might have felt like my problems are over, and make that assumption, take it for granted, and then the next minute you're expected to go back and face death.
No one wants to move from their own country. Your own country, your own city or town, your own village is heaven and paradise for you and your family. But sometimes it's pressure from the government and you haven't got any choice. I'm human, with meat and some bones. Not metal.
Everything Has Collapsed was produced by Vaska Trajkovska for the Refugee Radio Mentoring Project. Everything Has Collapsed was a documentary exploring the effects of being a refugee on identity and personal relationships. The producers would like to thank Saeed, the organisations Freedom from Torture and MedACT, MIND and NAFSIAT Intercultural Therapy Centre. Refugee Radio would like to thank Vaska and Saeed for their participation in the project and for producing the documentary that you've just listened to.